Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, fencers of all ages and genders. We are back for another edition of the Demimon. This is a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em. Do you want to do your announcement now or at the end?
No, I think we should do it now. So if you follow me on Twitter, you know, people have been asking if I'm ever going to sell some stuff, and I finally got my website together. So if you go to moltonforge.net, I know, shocker on the name, right? But you click on there, and it has, like, you know, a little bit about me, like a gallery. It has a shop. And if you look in the shop section, we've got our own official No Ship section in there that'll have, like, stickers, T-shirts that we're coming out with. If I make a piece that's kind of, like, driven by one of the shows that we watch, I put it in there. So, you know, everything that's in there, some of the proceeds come to No Ship for us to kind of run through. So it's another way to help us out. What else? I mean, I'm kind of glazing over a lot of stuff, and everything that we put in there, we're actually making ourselves. So, like, before we tried Zazzle and other websites, and this time it's all in house. It's all us. You know, if you buy a sticker, you know, just read everything really clearly. You can get free shipping just by reading and putting in a code that I've got on there. It's based for our listeners and for us to kind of give back, and, you know, something for y'all to get in return also. So it's a really cool thing. If you go to my Twitter feed, the link's on there, and it's moltonforge, moltonforge.net. Because I'm jerkhead.com, but what can I do?
Yeah.
What can I do? I want to thank everybody who's put in reviews this week. You know, it's fantastic. We're getting closer, please. You've got 3 more weeks to get us to the number that we want.
And I did share the picture of Paul's chalice on our Facebook and our Twitter. Mm-hmm. So, and a lot of people loved it.
Yeah. So definitely get there. If not, I've got a backup piece. And like I said, I'll be happy to keep it. So, or, and maybe I'll sell it. Who knows? Maybe I'll put it up for actual sale and you can buy it afterwards. But I'd rather give it away, you know, as a thank you for you guys kind of getting me and, well, getting us to the feedback level that we want to be. So thanks to everybody again for kind of like pushing me for this. And I hope you guys enjoy everything that we've put into it.
Thanks to everybody who has written a review. Thanks to everybody who continues to write feedback. Mm-hmm. And thanks to everybody who has chosen their way of contributing a little bit of financial support. Every little bit helps out, and we really appreciate it. We're a little bit past the mid-season right now, so I just want to give a shout-out to everybody who has donated, subscribed, or, you know, left a review. All the people who do feedback, you guys are definitely the ones who make this worth it for us. And thank you.
And if you're wanting to know how to do all of the things Steve just listed, you can go to our website at noship.net, click on our support page, and that will detail it all for you. And we even have links there to go to iTunes to write us a review as well.
Nice.
We are discussing Penny Dreadful, Season 3, Episode 6, No Beast So Fierce, written by Andrew Hinderaker and Christy Wilson-Cairns, and directed by Paco Cabezas.
Again, this is his second one in a row, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And also Andrew Hinderaker's second episode in a row.
I approve of it all.
Yeah, I agree.
I enjoyed this episode. It was a lot of fun to watch. A lot of surprises and humor and setups for what's to come.
Yeah, you're not kidding. I'm a little disappointed in Vanessa's choice in men, but what can we do? I mean,
fun is not a word that I normally associate with a Penny Dreadful episode, except in the sense that I'm having fun while I watch it. But this episode mm-hmm. was fun, to steal M's term. And it was just a joy to watch, and it got better every time I watched it. They usually do, but this one just kept getting better and better each time.
Mm-hmm. I kept catching stuff the more times I watched it on this watch, too.
Just the little looks that people have, especially the dinner table scene.
Yeah.
You know, the Last Supper, I guess, for a lot of people there.
Right.
They even had prayers and everything.
Everything. Episode opens up where we left off last season. Again, we hear Ethan say he is done repenting and that he belongs in hell. They are interrupted because they have a visitor. Rusk and his balls arrive. I mean, the American Marshall Ostow. Being that we're all balls and shit, but
I was a little surprised that his dad was like, okay, let's stop and take a break. It's like you just had a gun in his face But because you guys don't get visitors very often, you're willing to stop and go, okay, you know. So technically he saved Ethan's life or his dad's life, whichever way you want to look at it.
You can always repent later, but when you've got guests, it's entertainment time. Right? He's breaking out right? the good china. He's got everything. This scene reminded me of the scene from The Exorcist where Chris McNeil is like trying to figure out who put the cross under Reagan's pillow. And then Inspector Kinderman comes to the door and they're like, ma'am, a man to see you. And she's like, what man? You know, because he's all like, what? What do you guys want? What the fuck?
Exactly.
What man? Sorry.
No rats.
Like I said, it's the American Marshal Ostow. Rusk declares all of them to be under arrest within the joint authorities of the English and the American governments.
And then he laughs. He just kind of goes,
because I think he knew like how ridiculous it is or how unlikely he's going to be able to pull it off.
Yeah. I mean, it's two guys against a house full of like well-trained armed men plus the Dreadfuls. I mean, terrible.
Do you remember that AC/DC song? I can't recall the actual name. Maybe Metal Mike can help us out with this. Who has the biggest balls of them all? It's a real goofy, tongue-in-cheek kind of song, but that's immediately what I thought of. Because, I mean, you have to have huge back-of-the-redneck truck kind of brass balls.
Yes, for sure.
So now, after the opening credits, Dracula's thralls feast disgustingly while Dracula questions Renfield about Vanessa. Renfield reports of her abandonment by Malcolm and the one that Dracula knows as the Wolf. Dracula threatens Renfield for more information, so Renfield reports that Ives knows Dracula's name. Renfield begs for sweeties, and with the subtlest movement of Dracula's finger, the thralls are dispersed from the meaty man on the hook. Renfield gets his sweeties. It's so gross.
It is pretty disgusting because it pans up and you're just like, ugh.
It's a horrible scene transition. I mean, it's a great scene transition, but into a horrible thing where they're just the first, you know, thrall you see is just catching blood coming off of the body. And then all the rest of them just kind of gang up.
So like in some houses, people fight for like turkey necks or like certain parts of the turkey. Do you think the thralls do that when the body's on the hook? Are they fighting over genitals or meatier parts? Or is it just free for all?
Thighs are probably a big thing.
Some of them were biting into the sides of the buttocks. I noticed that.
Ah,
there you go. Right, it's probably a nice tender morsel.
Rump, right?
Rump, yeah, exactly.
Rump roast.
London broil, a little bit underdone.
So next, Ives visits Lyle. Finally, Lyle is about to take a trip to the fabulous city of Cairo. At first, he says it is just a jaunt. Then he says that this expedition might be extended indefinitely due to the Egyptian city's acceptance of Lyle's way of life. I thought it was strange that he was saying it's just a jaunt, but then he's like, well, I might actually be there a while. The important thing here, though, is that Lyle is taking a trip to the tomb of Imhotep.
Right? That's the fucking mummy, isn't it?
The title character of the mummy is Imhotep.
Yeah, even in the old school one from the 30s, it was Imhotep.
1932.
Weren't we talking recently about them bringing the mummy into it?
I had hoped Sam Benning would be a mummy.
Oh, yeah, right? I remember that.
I don't think he was brought to Egypt by Malcolm, no. So I doubt he's coming back. But it sounds like we are going to have a mummy if they renew Penny Dreadful.
And as everybody knows, Imhotep is a distant cousin to Bubba Hotep. In the same family, but not.
Real, I forgot about
real
the
close.
Countryside, Bubba. Yeah.
Ives seems wounded by Lyle's imminent departure, and he assures her life is too exciting for an old man like him. He asks her to write often and to think only of him when she dances. Before departing, she asks him for a referral to a man with a similar expertise as his own. He gives her information and says that he thinks that Ives and this person would make a formidable match. They say their goodbyes, and she says she shall have to dance more often, which I thought was super sweet.
Mm-hmm. I hope this is not the last we've seen of Lyle. He is one of my favorite characters, hands down.
Well, that they threw in the Imhotep makes me think he's going to maybe get scared and come back. You know, like something's going to freak him out and he'll be back to London. Maybe not this season, but I hope, you know, that would suck if we have to wait a year to get more Lyle, you know. But at the rate our characters are still spread out, who knows, you know.
I agree with you. I the first time I watched it, because when she departs, he seems to watch her he has this look on his face like, I felt like, oh God, this is the last time we're going to see him. We're not seeing him ever again. Like, he knows deep down. In the closed captioning, I saw that he said Imhotep because I didn't realize he said that the first time I watched it. That made me go, oh, he's definitely coming back because he's going to be the character that connects us to that, to the mummy.
Exactly. Maybe Imhotep will show up and he'll be another suitor for Ives. I need you to rule. Too much pressure.
I could see him coming back from this excursion to Cairo with a mummy, with Imhotep, and then that's like the beginning of next season. Like, Lyle returns and then throws a big soiree at his house, and everybody comes, and then the mummy comes out and
animates.
Yeah, somebody better at storytelling would have to take it from here, but you get the point.
Yeah, that's,
I like it.
Yeah, like, because maybe he takes it home or takes it to London for further study, and there you go.
Well, you know,
I think it's great.
Well, he's gonna come back eventually because he's not going to Egypt to look for a mummy. He's going to look for a daddy. Sorry, I'll stop. These jokes are lame tonight, but go ahead.
Well, remember that it was the Mayan mummy in Buffy, right? That was brought to Sunnydale.
I can't remember. You're probably right. If you remember it like that, I'll go with it because it's been so long.
Remember, because she hooked up with Xander. And she almost sucked the life out of Xander and turned him into a husk.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And in the first season, the vampires had hieroglyphs tattooed in their bodies.
Yeah.
So it could be a connection to Dracula also.
Oh, yeah. Good point.
The werewolf, Dracula, even the mummy are sure to end up in John Clare's tummy.
See Phantom Mass for that, the band. Okay. All right, so moving on now. So now we're with Jekyll and Victor, and Jekyll observes Victor as he decants a lab-created tranquilizer. And I tried to, like, do some searches to figure out what it is. It could be chloroform, and the only reason why I say that is because of the sudden sniffer's death that you could get, and because he tells him to be careful about smelling it.
He says, don't take any deep breaths.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I... You know, I didn't do, like, the deepest search about this. I did come across some other possibilities. I'm not sure if chloroform can actually take down an elephant. So.
Yeah, with these two, you never know. It could be half chloroform, some morphine mixed in from Victor's stash. Yeah, there's no telling. Yeah, some NyQuil. It's electrified.
Well, you know, with what Victor's trying to do, this could just be, like, Victorian-era roofies.
Right.
Because, I mean, he's basically the sexual innuendo that's going on about is borderline uncomfortable as far as because it's like, she'll be yours to do with as you want, old boy. And you're like, what? I thought you're trying to help her. You know, I mean,
exactly.
Yeah. With all the Brock Turner stuff I've been reading, that's like the first thing I thought. I was like, this is Victor. What the fuck are you doing?
Yeah. Bad timing on that. But, you know, it's fantasy and reality. So
who's Brock Turner? Is that kid?
The rapist.
Yeah, dirty kid, dirty fucker. Mm-hmm. I read that article or that statement she wrote.
Yes.
It's pretty powerful.
It is.
I intended to read it last night, but after we watched the episode again and I was just like shot, so I just went to bed.
Yeah, but it's talking about the particular tranquilizer. Jekyll says it is sure to bring her down because it can take down an elephant. Jekyll then asks if Victor still has the nerve to bring Lily into the lab. And Victor says, well, actually, Jekyll, you'll be the one who needs the nerve once she is brought around, because Jekyll has not met her and doesn't know how monstrous she is, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, luckily he hasn't met her. Otherwise, he'd be like, no, we need to destroy her.
Bad idea, Victor. Bad idea.
Go get a regular girlfriend.
So now we're at Dorian's estate, and some prostitutes have arrived to learn from the Pale Lady. So I looked up the Pale Lady, and it's a short story. Could be called a novella, which was written by Alexandre Dumas. He wrote The Count of Monte Cristo and The Three Musketeers. This was published in 1849, The Pale Lady, and it holds the distinction of being one of the first vampire tales to have been set in the Carpathians. And it also specifically has two brothers that are fighting over the female protagonist. One of the brothers is a vampire. Sound familiar?
Right.
So I thought that was interesting. Now, Lily is giving lessons on how to kill a man from various positions, and so follows with a speech about their revolution. This revolution of women who will be defending themselves. And these women are thought of as monsters because they do defend themselves, and she says that this is the world's crime, not theirs. Justine is game to practice on Dorian next, except she seems to want to take it further. She inquires menacingly about his history with fallen women. With lightning speed, she has the blade to his throat, which makes Lily gasp. Lily asks, who's next? But Justine isn't finished. She begins to draw his blood, and he tells her she is pushing her luck. Justine asks if Lily would like to see him drown in his own blood. Lily wonders, well, who would we practice on then? And Lily looks Justine straight in the eyes, forcing her to heal. Lily should just let her do it, because he's not going to die. But I guess...
Right.
But then you're playing that hand, so...
Mm-hmm. So we're assuming that Justine doesn't know about the immortality aspect of these two.
Mm-mm. Okay. No, for sure.
That's their secret. So I guess maybe that she shouldn't, because then it's going to be... You're going to have somebody possibly trying to find out why he's immortal.
Plus, they're really going to call them monsters. I mean, it's still the 1800s. Well, even now... You find out somebody's immortal, people are going to freak out, you know, so you got to make sure they're thoroughly brainwashed complete and then tell them.
Let me ask you guys something. Do you think that what is she training this army to do to be able to defend themselves against people who don't just want the regular business transaction involved with prostitution, or just to pretty much have any guy who tries to buy their services is going to get either his dick cut off, his throat slit, or cut and maimed somehow?
I think she wants to take over the world, personally. I think she wants to build an army and just grow stronger. And she knows she's immortal, so she's kind of playing it the slow way and getting... I mean, she's already got one person listening to everything she says to her beck and call. You know what I mean? So I think just building a larger and larger group and just getting more powerful, and she's using Dorian for his money to further all that, to where once she's done with him, you know she's going to toss him aside. So it's, I think she's doing it to literally take over London. Hmm. I really do.
I don't know. I will say that she wants to change the world.
Mm-hmm.
Justine definitely wants to kill every male. She's there. Mm-hmm. But Lily hasn't actually stated that. And when Justine wanted to kill Victor, Lily has to think about it, and she decides not to do it because she feels that he would be useful. I still don't get the impression that she's down to just kill every man. I don't think she knows exactly what full extent she wants to go. I think right now it's just about what Steve said, that she's going to be going after men who are trying to hurt women. And the best way to do it is the women who are most vulnerable are the prostitutes, mm-hmm. who have no legal protection.
Well, this is what cults prey on in modern times too, is that they go for people who are hurt, you know, cracked and wounded and broken, because they're willing to listen and follow just to try and make their lives a little better. So I agree that she's using these women for that, but I also think that she's just massing power. I don't know if she's definitely going to take over London, but that's, to me, that's what she's doing. She's just gaining power.
Yeah, I think saying massing power, it gave me like a visual of this like storm cloud building up in the horizon. And mm-hmm. that's to me like really representative of her anger. I don't think she knows what she's going to do with it, but she's just mm-mm. building this thing, and it's all coming from that memory source of Brona. And
exactly.
You know, eventually she's going to unleash it, but I don't think she really has a clear focus of exactly how.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But she knows where she's going to start, and it's going to be with Johns who are abusing women.
So it's like a foundation. If she can get these women empowered to be able to do this thing, then she can ask other things of them that don't have to do directly with killing guys or Johns or whatever have you. Then they can move on to other areas.
Yeah, she's like Thulsa Doom in Conan. Why do I need steel when I've got an army of people?
Come to me, my child.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So meanwhile, John Clara pays a visit to his consumptive son. He is brought to his bedside when he sees his son's need of water. The poor boy, eyes closed, thanks him and recognizes his father's voice and asks if his father is there and if he's an angel. He talks of his imminent death and how he will soon see angels. He hopes that one of the angels would be his father. When he suddenly erupts into coughs, John Clare embraces him. He then promises his son that he will bring him medicine. When he lies back and opens his eyes and he sees John, he begins to scream, sending John running and tormented out into the dark night.
This scene is sad. This scene's really sad because
all of his this season have been pretty heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
He doesn't have any like happy poetry moments. It's all just the doom and gloom emo guy moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he's living in rafters, for fuck's sake. I mean, and I still don't see how they're holding him up. And then when he's down there and he's like wiping his son's head, you think the kid would have felt cold, dead hands on him. You know, like, what the? You know, it would have been the first initial thing. And then when he sees him, it's like, well, tell him some poetry. Do something other than stand there and go, and look even scarier. Say something, you know, like, oh, well, I work at a playhouse, anything. Put some makeup on.
You're this kid's dad. I mean, you're dead in return, but you're this kid's dad. And you can just be like, lay down and chill out, or you're grounded, bud. But that's something. Not really going to work because a kid's got consumption. Or, you know what I mean? Like, try to throw that fatherly authority behind it. Be like, it's okay. Yeah. It's okay. But, I mean, I guess anybody in that position would probably do the same thing. They just get up
absolutely.
Because he doesn't want to cause any more distress to the poor kid.
Yeah, luckily he didn't try and, like, shush him and hurt him by accident, you know? You know, like, here, like, hold him too tight and he dies.
Yeah.
Like a mice of men trying to pet his head, break his
exactly.
neck.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. Yeah, so he's tormented and it's sad. So next scene, Ives watches a fencing match while waiting to meet with a person Lyle has recommended. Catriona Hartigan wins the match with skill, but also with improvisation and resourcefulness. After her opponent responds in an angry outburst, she lands a pun when she says, I think that is rather the point. Touché again, sir. Ha ha. When he asks her name and threatens to have her removed from the league, this is said before he knew she was female, of course. She mentions she is not on that league, but for not for lack of trying. And this is because I'm thinking because she's female and they were not allowed to be a part of the league. Ives and Catriona have a locker room chat. Ives learns that Catriona is a thanatologist. Now, this is cool. It is a real study. It's a real field of study. However, it didn't really come about till 1903, so it's not... I guess it's anachronistic, you could say, but I don't really care because it's super cool and she's super cool. Mm-hmm. I'm excited about this character.
It's pretty.
Oh, I know.
It's pretty bold to introduce a character like this far into the season. It's like I mentioned before, we're pretty well past the halfway point here. We got 3 episodes left, so I mean, it's to bring in somebody who's probably going to have some effect on the way that things, you know, turn out is a. Usually,
well, Ives needs her more than ever. So at least they gave her own little pistol. And that's how I look at this woman. She's like a perfect like sneak attack because Dracula, if he's been watching Ives, has no idea who this woman is, has no clue that she's there. So this could be what saves Vanessa's life in the long run. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I'm happy. I agree. I think she was like a bright shining moment. Like, whoa, who is this? Yeah. You know, she was awesome.
Did you guys know that it was going to be a woman fighting that guy?
Yeah, by the build, tell.
I didn't even.
I had guessed that. I had guessed that that's going to be a woman because that'll be the reveal. Mm-hmm. He'll get his ass kicked and then she'll. So it was the scene was predictable in a way, but the execution of it makes that completely forgivable. And then the locker room scene afterward makes it all even better. And then when they go have drinks, it goes up to the next level.
Exactly. So, you could tell, not to sound sexist, but it's all on the shoulders.
Well, I wasn't even thinking about the fact that Ives was looking for this guy. I just was like, oh, we got a fencing match.
Yeah, she just,
so I'm just like, right. Cool, watching it. And then, you know, I mean, she's kind of slim-hipped, so I didn't like go, oh, that's a woman. So, anyway. Moving on. So Catriona is intrigued when she sees that Ives does not flinch at her choice of profession, since most people typically do. And they actually do, because I was talking to my coworker about this episode, and I mentioned thanatology being the study of death, and she actually flinched.
Nice.
So Ives declares that she is not like most people, so they continue their conversation in a pub. They are the only females in this pub, and men can be seen milling about and chumming it up in the background. Ives gets straight to the point, asking Catriona what she knows about Dracula. Catriona offers what she knows, and I've got what she said here. There was a medieval warrior clan of sorts, the Dracule. The line can be traced back to antiquity, perhaps further. Dracula was said to be their founder. The name means dragon in Romanian. In the 13th century, he provoked a war between two great empires, the Ottomans and the Holy Romans, because he wanted the world to be wet with blood. The peasants believed that he fed upon it, that he was, well, a vampire. He was said to be the first vampire. One of the few written accounts of him is Ottoman. It tells of an ancient being flushed with youth, a strategist, changing his appearance and identity from century to century. It calls him a seducer, but in the antiquated form of the word, one who is able to lead men astray, to corrupt. Beyond that, there's not a lot. So she offers to look some more for Dracula, but Ives says she does not wish to find him in history. She wants to find him in London now. And she tells Catriona that Dracula hunts her because he wants her submission and not her death. Catriona continues to be pleased at Ives' unblinkiness, but Catriona is very unblinky herself. Mm-hmm. She does not blink when Ives says that she is being hunted by Dracula. Ives asks for Catriona's help. Catriona says she will, but in the meantime, Ives should protect herself and surround herself with those that are dear. Ives frets that those that are dear have all gone, but then she reflects there may still be someone. I think this is meant to worry us that it is Dr. Sweet she is referring to.
Yeah, it's one link away when you think about it, because she says there is one, and then she goes and has drinks with Dr. Seward, and then she tells her to go, you know, hook up with Dr. Sweet. So
yeah,
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just gonna say I like how Catriona is kind of filling in for Lyle here, because I could hear Lyle giving the same advice, saying you need to be around people who care about you, who are out for your well-being. You know, he's like just thinking like, where did that house full of wonderful men go that you used to live with? You know,
which is why he's leaving. He's like, eh.
Yeah,
I'm going to find some more. Yeah, he's like, eh. Just a bunch of girls.
Do write to me when they come back.
Right.
Oh yeah. So this was my favorite scene in the episode. I would like to see more scenes like this where you have a meeting of the minds and they are women in all visual media, actually. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, there was a lot of very subtle sexiness in this episode, because the one sex scene that we do get, there's no nudity, and it's still pretty hot and well executed. I thought it was this censor approves of that sex scene. Anyway, more on that when we get to it. But I thought that you know, the new girl Catriona, she's really good looking. I don't know what the best way to say, easy on the eyes or whatever, but you try to find, as a guy, you try to find creative ways to say that without sounding like a sexist goofball. You know, she's hot. Mm-hmm. But that's
beautiful.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah,
yeah, that's a good way.
Charming, intelligent, all of the nice things. And but it was done in a very subtle way. It wasn't like she went to go meet Ives somewhere in a risque outfit, or like Ives came. Yeah, I think a lesser writer would have had a scene where Ives catches her like halfway undressed because she's getting into her street clothes, and then you see some flesh and you're like, ooh, titillation.
I mean, I hate to bring Vikings up, but like Lagertha, to where she's sexy in that powerful, confident kind of way. Her whole, just like with this new character, she's the same way. You know, she's super confident and knows what she wants to do, and it comes off. And confidence is always very appealing, I think, to either sex.
Yeah.
And all you ever see is really, when they're during that conversation, is both their faces. I noticed that too. So there wasn't like any, you know, camera gradually moving down their form, and, you know, or even men checking them out from a distance, like you'll see sometimes. No hints towards their physical attractiveness. It was just what they were saying is what mattered. So now Victor is shimmying his way into Dorian's estate, and he's not doing a dance. The ones who are dancing are Lily and Justine, and Dorian tries to cut in and is told he can have the next one. Perturbed, he turns off the music, asking for a moment alone with the pale lady. Justine and the coterie of fallen women exit for the moment.
Am I the only one? Am I alone in this? I think the scenes where they're dancing in Dorian's house, no matter who is dancing, they're boring.
No, see, I like it.
You do? Okay, so
yeah, because of because of what's going on in the house, you know, it's like this whole episode kind of really made me pay more attention to Dorian and Lily, and just the fact that you start to see her kind of gain favor, or not gain favor, but kind of take notice to lieutenant's name, Justine.
Yeah.
And then you see Dorian kind of start acting like Victor, you know what I mean? To where he kind of has his moment like a teenager, like, oh, I'll just turn it off. Fine. Y'all aren't going to dance if I can't cut in. So we see her. I mean, it's really interesting just the way that she treated him in this episode, to where it makes me wonder if she's going to turn on him fairly soon. Hmm. You know what I mean? Because she doesn't, without, all she's really using right now is money. And does she really love, it made me question if she really did love him or like him being nearby. I mean, all of it just kind of floats together. Even in the scene coming up with Victor, he's the one pleading, and he's like, why are you going to kill him? Just because he loves you? Well, he also killed me and turned me into a fucking monster. That could be another great reason. But he's pleading for the because of the love aspect, you know. So it's almost like she's doing the same thing to him that she did with Victor, you know. So really, when they dance, it's almost like they're learning how their moves with each other. Because if you noticed, Lily was leading, you know. So it's, you know, Brona, or I keep wanting to call her Brona. I got to train myself to call her Lily. You know, she's leading and she has a lieutenant. And that she even says when they talk in this scene, she's like, well, she gets me because she's been there, because we remember all these terrible things to where it's like he doesn't have any other connection with her other than that he thinks he loves her and he is immortal. He's like, well, we're immortal. We're together, when really she has more of a connection with this girl than him. So it seems like she's steadily trying to push him out. So I love it. I absolutely love the dance scenes and everything now going along with it, to where I'll probably rewatch some of the episodes with them in it and see if I can catch some more, you know?
Well, that's how she first started pushing Victor out, was through the dance scene, because when she started dancing with Dorian at that ball at his house, that's when that whole that whole negativity between her and Victor started.
Oh, nice.
So I think it shows who's in her favor. Who she wants to dance with is who's in her favor.
Okay, so if we're looking at it like that, it makes more sense. I can be more accepting of the scene, because there's subtext to be seen there. I just feel like idiot for not seeing it now. That's fine. But it's just, I don't like, whenever the dancing is going on and she's part of it, I almost tune out just for a second. I imagine a Dalek coming out from around the corner and be, where is the doctor? You know, just, it's like, all right, no more dance scenes.
But if they were smart and they could hide like one of the doctors in one episode, just as a stand-in somewhere, it would be phenomenal. Phenomenal. Not a line, nothing. Just like one of the doctors buying scones on the street or something. Yeah. Just like, oh, shit.
Tom Baker with his scarf.
Something. It would be genius, but that's because I'm a
Dick, got a more charitable view of the scene, because now I want to go back and rewatch all the scenes that have dancing in it, because there's more to it than just, hey, we're dancing.
You would have to start with last season. Like I said, Dorian, frustrated, he turns off the music. He asks for a moment alone with Lily. Justine and the fallen women exit for the moment. Dorian fears that Justine does not know her place, and apparently Justine feels the same about him. Ooh. So there's been some discussion going on behind the scenes. Dorian plays the "you and I are immortals together" card, as Paul had already said, but Lily shares a soul with Justine. And so the soul equates with past, and which also equates with memories. There's been discussion about memories making people monsters, which is commentary on Lily's and Justine's soul. And I just want to bring up real quick that Steve said last episode that, in his opinion, it's actions, not memories, that make you a monster. And I do agree with this. And I think the show agrees with this too. And that is why the whole "be who you are" sentiment is being thrown around, because "be" is an action verb. So that's why we've gone from "know who you are" to "be who you are."
I like that.
Self-actualization.
So Victor is way wrong.
I've been saying that too. He is on the wrong path, and he's one of my favorite characters. And this, when we got to this scene, I looked at Em and I said, God, please don't be a bunch of prostitutes in there when he breaks in. You know what I mean? Like, hopefully it's just like Dorian and Lily, and he could try to do whatever foolish plan he's got, but please. And then the next thing you see they're all there, just kind of smoking and drinking and hanging out, having a good old time.
So Lily goes on to talk about all the men who used her, abused her, bent her into submission. All of Brona's shame and debasement. She's disassociating herself from Brona. So she's bearing the pain of Brona's memories as her own, but she separates herself from the dark and dank emotions of degradation. And she also says, and everything she being Brona, lost along the way. And I think this is another allusion to Ethan. So the fact that he's been alluded to twice, they have to encounter each other this season.
I hope so, but who knows how long it's going to take for him to come back. Hopefully we get a Vikings travel scene to where all of a sudden it's like a month later and they're back in town, you know, like, hey.
I think he's going to be back next episode.
God, I hope so. I want the Dreadfuls back together, Lyle and all, by the end of the season, when I'm writing a letter. I'm not sending an email. It's coming through the mail, postage and all.
Yeah. Old school.
Dorian talks of becoming something different and that they can make the world what they want. Lily says they shall, but she has committed to these women. Dorian says he wishes he could understand, but he does understand kissing her, so he does just that. She kisses back, saying if only that were all it could be. Justine interrupts and announces there's an intruder. The women behind her have Victor with a knife at his throat.
Dumbass.
You're bad at this stuff.
Yeah, for as smart as he is, he's a dumbass.
Yeah. You got to know what you're good at. You got to play your zone, you know? It's right? it's not a bad idea to branch out and be a well-rounded person. They say that's the key to happiness. Either be one thing completely, you know, and just put all your time into it, be the best at whatever you're going to do, or be a well-rounded person, you know? But this isn't working for Victor. He should have taken up chess or something.
Well, he had options at the... I was thinking about this the second time I watched it. And he had options at that hospital. There are guys that are working... you know, at Bedlam, who are used to manhandling, they're bigger guys. It would be an option to maybe go to them with some money and have them come with you to grab her. Cause there's no way, even if she wasn't an immortal and strong, could he drag anybody anywhere? You know,
yeah,
so it's like,
yeah.
Oh man, you need someone to help you. What are you going to do? She's going to pass out. You're not going to be able to move her. You're not strong enough.
You're right. I mean, Vicky would, without chloroform, he would have a hard time with me.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So it's like...
the fact that you're right. He should play his own zone. He shouldn't be out trying to apprehend her in any way. Mm-hmm. But before even that, he needs to actually function like a real scientist. Oh, he waits, what, 24 hours to see Balfour wake up and doesn't observe him for any longer than that. And he's ready to inject the woman he loves with this stuff. And it hasn't actually really done a good scientific method style research on this shit.
No.
You're right.
No,
that's
he's
a good
delusional.
Point.
Yeah.
Yeah. He believes so much in his own hype and so much in, you know, Henry's research that he just feels like he just kind of needs to do some tweaks to that. The two of them, I mean, they don't believe that anybody else would be able to teach him anything. So it's kind of like they go, hey, you came up with a good idea. I made it better. It's going to work. Let's go.
He's desperate. Yeah.
And he's desperate.
They're like the most impatient doctors ever.
Yeah.
Oh, it didn't work. Do it again. You know, do it again. It could be a funny like 1800s sitcom. You know, the impatient doctors where they're just doing ridiculous shit the entire time.
The Odd Couple, 1892.
Yeah, right, it would.
So now Ives is unloading her pain of abandonment to Dr. Seward over drinks and in front of a cozy fire. The camera does not allow you to see who she is talking to at first, and it's toying with the viewer, worrying us that she is detailing just exactly how vulnerable she is to maybe Dr. Sweet. And of course, when we see that it's Dr. Seward, you're relieved. And we also get Dr. Seward's story of who she actually killed, and it was her husband, and she killed him with a cleaver. She talks about how she was ostracized after her trial, and she was probably treated like a monster because she refused. When she talks about her ostracization after she killed her husband with a cleaver, it makes me think about women defending themselves and kind of what Lily was saying down the road, how, you know, the world is, they're the ones who define you as monsters for defending yourself. And that's the world's crime, not theirs. And so by the end of the scene, Dr. Seward tells Ives to go see Dr. Sweet. So now Justine is holding the knife.
Well,
okay.
Real quick. There's like 3% of me, maybe 4%, that makes me think she might be in league with Dracula. Now, I know, I'm hoping not, but that she was quickly like, why don't you go see that handsome devil of a doctor? Do you know what I mean? It's like, I don't know. I could be pretty far-fetched, but there is a piece of me that's like, hey, you know, is she... in league, I know he wouldn't need Renfield. That's the thing that always throws the wrench.
Yeah.
Like, why would he need Renfield? But I don't know. There's just some,
yeah,
I'm
the Renfield thing does clinch it because you're just like, what? Because I mean, what Dr. Seward was able to find out from Vanessa is orders of magnitude higher than what Renfield could do. Because all he can come up with to be able to go chew on some leg fat is, hey, she knows your name. You know, so.
I know. Well, that's what I'm saying, like 2-3%. It was just a little piece of me that was like, man,
it would be
she needs her friends. That's the whole thing.
Yeah.
I understand why you have that 3%, but I just want her to be her ally so badly.
I totally agree
to join up with you. So now Justine is holding the knife at Victor's throat and is itching to slice. Lily is tickled by Victor's clumsy attempt to kidnap her. He tells her about the medicine he has that will obliterate her rage and sadness. Unblemished by sadness is what he says. And remember, Brona meant sadness.
Mm-hmm.
Unblemished by Brona, essentially. Hmm. She says she has suffered long and hard to be who she is. And Victor says they were happy. And she says, no, you were happy. And that she was actually just waiting. Justine is ready to kill Victor, and Dorian argues against it. Justine yells at Dorian, saying that she does not take orders from a man. And her reasoning to kill Victor is simply because he is a man. Lily says no to Justine, saying they may need his unique services later. She hugs Victor to her, telling him to ease his conscience with another and that she is done with him. She warns him that the next time she does see him, she will be holding the razor herself. Dorian walks Victor out, telling him that Victor is in his debt and that he will call on it. And this got me actually a little excited, so I can't wait to see what he wants.
I think I know. I have a
what?
I have an idea. He's going to wait until this escalates a little bit further. He's going to try to convince Lily to get rid of this little chick and then be, you know, just be done with her. Be like, all right, stop playing your game. Let's go back to being immortals and dancing around all day and all that shit. She's not going to have any of it. She wants Justine to be her lieutenant in this new army, like you guys are saying.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Victor is going to have Justine brought to him by Dorian. And he's going to say, put your serum in this one. And then he's going to make him do it. And then she's just going to be innocent as a doe. And that's going to be the worst thing that could happen to Lily's plans.
You don't think that possibly he would do... See, I thought something similar, but maybe that he would do it. He would help Victor with Lily because he wants her pretty much like Victor does, like all,
yeah.
Oh, you know, because he's used to being her number one beau at this point. So maybe that's what gets... Because he would have the means to have that happen.
That's legitimate. Yeah, I can't argue with that, actually.
Well, another thing I want to point out is we still have this tranquilizer that's not used. So that may be used maybe to bring down Ethan or maybe subdue Dracula. I mean,
oh, Victor's going to go home pouty and shoot that into himself. Are you kidding?
He's going to take a little me time.
I would like to see it used. Just like the what was it? The poison in Breaking Bad that was kept in the
ricin?
Yeah, the ricin from Breaking Bad that eventually popped back up again.
That would be sweet if all of a sudden that was there.
Yeah, that would
awesome.
Be cool.
Or he'll use it on Dr. Jekyll, you know, whenever he snaps.
Hide,
and he's got, whoa.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Settle down, old boy.
That's probably exactly what's going to happen, because he's going to discover Hyde in that lab, and there it is, that stuff. He's going to make Hyde take a big whiff.
Next episode, yeah, he'll be fucking shooting himself in the eye with the serum. Fuck.
I was wondering how he's going to do that. It's just run face first into the syringe so he doesn't have to slowly
put
it in.
That's fucked. That is so fucked up. I just see it's like mounted on a board.
Yeah.
misses and hits his forehead. that's awesome. Well, would that serum work on someone like Lily, though?
We don't know. And that's the thing.
That's right. We never found out. Yeah.
I mean, he hasn't done proper research to find that out.
Dumbass.
Well, you can't. He's just hoping that it will, because the physiology of somebody who's been dead and brought back to life has to be considerably different than somebody who is still living. So
it's not like he gives a crap about John Clare. John Clare like threatened him the last time he saw him with like electrocuting him. I'm not advocating he goes out and gets John Clare and brings him in to test. But I mean, he is a resource for him that he doesn't
That's
give
true.
A shit about. So why didn't he go ahead and do that?
This next episode could start with him reanimating somebody else and then using the serum on them to see what happens. We don't know.
Well, he doesn't seem to be concerned whether it's going to work or not. He just is more concerned about getting Lily in there, and he's actually quite sure it's going to work on Lily.
Hmm. Well, see, JC's son's going to die, so then he's going to take his son to Victor and reanimate it, and then they're going to use it on the kid.
The Addams family.
That would be
one
awful.
Big undead family.
Oh, God.
And then the Munsters are created in the 60s.
He's going to have a massive widow's peak after he's been turned into a creature. So now back at the Talbot Ranch, it is supper time. Big ballsy men, hunks of beef, guns, and a woman are at the table.
Everything you need.
Yeah, right?
Some pre-dinner repartee first, and then Jared taps Ethan to say grace. He is sitting in the grace saying chair, after all. Malcolm offers to do it instead. Jared insists that it should be Ethan, so Malcolm cautions Jared against being so hard on his only remaining son. Jared outs Ethan's involvement with his family's murder. During the speech, Hecate offers herself as a weapon for Ethan upon his word, yet he can't make the call. Rusk also is taunting Ethan during this spectacle.
Doesn't he say something to the effect of, I'm as hungry as a, or no, I'm thinking.
I'm as ravished as.
I'm as ravenous as a, like he's going to say beast, you know, uh-huh. or wolf, you know.
Well, he doesn't know what Ethan is, so he looks at Ethan like a what?
Fill
like.
In the blank. We're mad living right here. He's over, Rusk is over in the corner whistling, hungry like a wolf.
And he's playing footsies with him under the table, I'm sure.
And he's what?
Right.
Playing footsies too. Totally yeah, flirting.
Poking him.
I'm on the prowl.
Totally confused. Do you want to kill me? Fuck me. I don't know.
There's a lot of confusion at this table, and there's a lot of humor in this scene, and I believe it's all intentional.
Oh, yeah. It, like, well, it's like a terrible Thanksgiving they're sitting down yeah. to. It's like, oh, God.
God, did you see the big steaks on their plates? They were huge.
Yes.
They looked
really
overcooked,
too. We really don't eat like
that
over here.
Yeah, yeah. For all those people listening in other countries, that's not how Americans eat. That is a very caricatured version.
I know people talk about our portion sizes, people who come here from other countries.
Oh, for sure.
And but nobody does.
Well, that was like an 18-ounce steak, though. Yes. I mean, let's be real. That thing was thick.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not a usual fare for anybody mm-hmm. unless you're, like Emmett pointed out, unless you're somewhere out in the West and you're at one of those places that lets you eat for free if you can eat this massive amount of food that wasn't designed to go into a human body at that volume and that short of a time.
Yeah. Plus, they're living in the middle of the desert. How are they keeping these cows alive?
Do you know how much water it takes to keep cows like yeah. producing beef? It's alive to produce beef rather. It's staggering. I mean, they would have to yeah. have like wells on that property that were just
wells, and they're eating dirt. I don't know. I mean, everything was dead around it. Rivers yeah. are drying up.
Yeah.
Probably human meat they were feeding them.
Maybe they're horses. Who knows?
Could be horse.
Yeah.
And they had corn on the cob and carrots.
Nice. I didn't even notice the corn on the cob. It was a very uncomfortable meal, though. I mean, even the guys that were standing behind were probably like, man, this sucks. I just need to take a step back.
I've seen this guy throw some bad parties, but this takes the cake.
Right?
So, in order to shut his father up, Ethan says grace to Lucifer.
Oh, man.
Which was hilarious and possibly worrisome, but I think not in the end for two reasons. First, Malcolm did announce that he believes Ethan to be a good man, and you can see that it had its effect on Ethan. Also, if you really listen to what Ethan is saying during the blasphemous grace, he's actually denouncing and pointing out his father's own hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I have it here. He says, "Our Father, who art in heaven, cursed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be spited on earth as it is in hell. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us not our trespasses, as we never forgive those who trespass against us."
That's when it tipped me off that he was yeah. definitely talking about his dad.
I totally missed that.
"Lead us into temptation and deliver us to evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory." So the marshal tells Jared there will be a reckoning for the men he killed on the train. Because Jared noticed he's been staring at him this whole time and wants to know why. So the marshal gets a bullet to his head. Ethan and Hecate continue to eat. The look on Ethan's face is hilarious. He is laughing bitterly on the inside, it looks like to me. I want to point out that Jared shot the marshal in the head because this guy said, basically, there's going to be a reckoning. I'm going to deal with you eventually. And yeah. So he's not going to let this guy be on his ass. So he kills him. And Malcolm Murray does the same thing when he kills Jared because Jared's promising to hunt Ethan for the rest of his life. So when Jared was saying that it was like looking in a mirror, well, right here, they are very much alike in that way, right? So.
Yeah.
So he was right about at least that detail.
Well, I like the way Hecate said something at the end of the prayer too, right?
She said at least for like, because he's saying that this is God's kingdom in the prayer, and he's all like, mm-hmm. she says, well, at least for a few hours more anyway.
Yes, that made me laugh. And then when he shot the marshal, I just felt terrible. It's like, oh my God, poor guy, you know? Rusk went this whole time without a gun, and I guess he did fare a little better. Not much, but he did last 10 minutes longer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that scene. This is one of the reasons why I love this episode. And that scene and with the Catriona and I've seen, I want to say this is my favorite episode this season.
I could see it.
And I know a lot of people like the Ives and John Clare episode. That was great performances. But as far as like having this.
There's more to this episode. There's more to love.
Yeah.
Yeah, you really had to, like, yeah, that one episode was sold on the acting capabilities of those two people. And this episode just gives you, it's a buffet, you know, it gives you a little bit of everything. So,
well, they've brought it every episode. They've stepped up and done something different, giving you something you haven't seen. I mean, it's, like you said, it's a buffet of just everything you love about the show. Yeah, right. A buffet of meat.
Of sweet, juicy fat.
Sweet treats.
Yeah.
Buffet of meeks and sweeties.
Sweeties.
Did you think that Renfield was kind of like Gollum in that scene when he was talking?
For sure.
Yeah.
So now Ives visits with Dr. Sweet, as Dr. Seward has suggested to her. She wants him to know she is dangerous, and she sets out to tell him that a creature has been hunting her since the dawn of time. He does not blink and asks if this creature has a name. She tells him he is called Dracula and asks if he believes her. He wants to show her something, so he draws her over to some bats. She eyes a wolf. He notices this, and he looks a little jelly there.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. He needed some peanut butter with that jelly, for sure. You could see it. You could see it.
So he, like, takes a bat, and he just, like, puts it in front of her eyes, like, look at this. Look at this.
Look what I got. Look what I got.
It's not so bad. It has to because it has to.
I don't drink blood because I like it. I mean,
gross.
I have to.
Yeah, and he basically says that they have to. He starts talking about the bats and how they need to feed on blood or they die. And this is, in a way, if you look at it and you compare to what Catriona was saying about Dracula, this is the sympathetic version of her tale. And Ives actually points out his apparent sympathy. He says he has no sympathy for any creature that means her any harm. He offers his protection. She alludes to Ethan and his abandonment of her. Dr. Sweet says nothing she has said has scared him away from her, and that he will never leave her side. They begin to kiss, and she fears catastrophe. He says he loves who she is and not who the world wants her to be. Therefore, she lunges, and it is on, and she's on top. Like Lilith, huh? Donuts, huh? No catastrophe, it turns out. She weeps with joy, and they embrace.
They made me feel like that friend, you know, when your friend is like about like dating somebody you dislike, and you're like, ugh, so stupid. The entire scene, I was like, ugh, come on, you know, it's ridiculous. Because, I mean, if you think a person in this guy's shoes, a scientist and everything, wouldn't be like, oh, a vampire? He'd be like, come on, I'm a scientist. There's no such thing as vampires. I believe in these animals, and that's it. But I understand Vanessa's extremely vulnerable, and Dracula is a pimp. So what can you do? You know, he's smooth. He's been smooth this whole time.
And like I said earlier, great sex scene. Didn't even have to have any nudity, but totally sold it. So
yeah,
for what it's worth, I liked it.
I couldn't enjoy it, though. I hate that she's with him.
God. You're like Dorian over there, like knocking the needle off the record. You're like, stop
for
this.
Sure.
Oh, Dorian would stop
knocking the bat off the pedestal.
They look over and it's just like. No, but Dorian wouldn't have stopped anything. He just would have watched and then tried to join.
Oh, he would have dove in. Yeah. Dorian would have been naked in about a second and oiled up somehow. And would have just slip and slide in the middle of there.
Like, I haven't had sex with a vampire yet.
Dracula's
with
like
dead animals around me.
Dracula's just like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Hey, hey, settle down.
So now back to dinner at the Talbot Ranch. Jared notices that some are not eating and he encourages them to do so. Rusk asks, who summoned the snakes? Jared asks, what is this, Ethan? And so more on that, because this underlines something I think Steve's going to talk about.
Yeah.
Ethan says, let me show you. Hecate has dropped her glamour. Guns are drawn and fired. Rusk, Hecate, and Ethan are now in a penny dreadful Mexican standoff. Rusk asks, what are you? Hecate says, the end of days. Malcolm makes a move on a Talbot henchman, and this causes Hecate to begin her lunge towards Rusk, and he shoots her down, and Ethan shoots Rusk. Kaitane appears on the scene. Hecate tells Ethan that hell awaits them both, and then she dies.
So, a couple of things about this scene. This delivers the second Slayer album name in this episode, Hell Awaits. The first one's technically not really there, because they said make the world wet with blood. Slayer has an album called World Painted Blood, so I'm counting it. It's close enough.
I think,
but
it totally works.
But then she says Hell Awaits, and I'm like, look, that's twice in one episode. It's worth bringing up. But
well, when most of your album names are related to Satan or hell
and blood,
I'm pretty sure there's going to be a few more in some Penny Dreadful seasons.
It's not too hard to shoehorn it in here somewhere.
So the best thing about this scene to me was when Malcolm Murray has his knife and he says, it's pretty, you know, pretty much it's pretty boneheaded of you to give your guests knives. Do you know who we are at this table? You've got me. I'm pretty much a badass. You've got Rusk over here who is just trying to arrest. He's drugged people through Africa with one arm, you know, without seeking medical attention. You've got a satanic witch, and then you've got a werewolf right there. And there's a crazy Indian somewhere outside right now.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Hopefully. And it's like you're giving these people knives. And it did turn out to be a pretty bad thing. So, but the one thing I was going to mention was that Rusk had said last episode that he would not hesitate to shoot Ethan in the back. He has the chance to do so, and he doesn't do it.
Well, he's going for the demon in front of him first, which I totally get.
Well, it's a standoff kind of thing, because he has the gun trained on his back. Then he sees her out of the corner of his eye, but he doesn't take his shot. He waits, and then now he's kind of stuck because she's got a bead on him, and he's.
Well,
I'm so glad she died.
Well, both, because he's Ethan's counterpart, kind of like if you like go back to Spartacus, because remember they all had counterparts. Like Gannicus was Julius Caesar, and Crassus was Spartacus. Blah blah blah. So Ethan said he would kill his father, and he couldn't do it. Just like Russ couldn't shoot Ethan in the back.
It's a good point.
And they were both saying they were going to go against codes that they had in a way, and they really didn't fully commit to going against their codes. So
I'm just glad she's dead. Goodbye, well, dirty witch.
What I actually thought you were going to mention, Steve, is the fact when he asks Ethan to explain what Rusk was talking about regarding the summoning of snakes was the fact that and the fact that he dies, he's not a werewolf.
Yeah, I'm sure some of our listeners are going to bring this up, but we were discussing this last night after we watched it the third time, that this proves that nobody, maybe K-Town knows, probably likely that K-Town knows, but nobody else knew in his family that he was a werewolf. So this is something that happened after he left the homestead and joined the army, and, you know, it happened with the Apaches, or it's something that was latent in him and came out at some point for whatever reason, and that's going to be given to us at a later date, but his dad didn't know, so his dad's not one.
Yeah.
So we never got that teen wolf moment where he's like,
thank God.
Open up the door, Ethan, I understand. I understand.
I didn't want his dad to be a werewolf. I like that we still don't know. It's one of the few questions that I think I enjoy not knowing. I might not like the answer, you know?
Yeah.
Might be lame.
Like Dorian's portrait.
Mm-hmm. Maybe his dad cursed him. You know, who knows?
Well, he threatened to curse him.
I know. That's why I was glad he shot him when he did. Like, oh, no. We've had enough of those.
Yeah.
So, on to that. Jared has made his retreat to the chapel, yelling for Ethan to face him there. Jared has all of his remaining henchmen setting up in defense. Ethan counsels Malcolm on how to enter the chapel, knowing how his father will place his men. Malcolm asks about Kaitane, and Ethan says he knows what to do because he has attacked this chapel before.
Ooh, Ethan, burn.
Ethan and Malcolm approach the threshold of this chapel, and Ethan stares hard at his father. Kaitane blows through one of the walls, and rounds are now being unloaded. Ultimately, Ethan has his father at gunpoint, and his father taunts him into shooting him dead, calling out Ethan's manhood. Ethan tears up and puts his gun away and begins to walk away. Jared begins to say how typical, you have always ran away and not being a man, blah, blah, blah. Malcolm shoots him dead.
Total, complete Indiana Jones move right there.
Oh, for sure.
Just like in Raiders of the Lost Ark when the guy's swinging the sword and Harrison Ford's just like, yeah. Like, and he just pops
I've got
him.
The flu.
Now, if Malcolm hadn't been there and Little Witchy Poo had been there, would he have done it?
Yeah, I would say so. I would, because she would, if she survived, she would have worked him up into a fervor. And
for sure.
You know, he'd be like, just pushing all his darkest tendencies to the forefront, and he'd be he would be in a state, and he would have, yeah. I think so. He might have even done it with his bare hands. Who knows?
For sure. And now that Daddy's there to save him, it's good. It's
Daddy good. Malcolm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he calls him, you know, Kaitne and him both say, oh, we need to save our son. And, you know, during that dinner, he's like, oh, you know, I used to say the same things to my son. Quit saying these things. You'll wish you hadn't. So he cares for him. You know, obviously he's gone all the way to the United States to get him. So it was nice seeing him step in. And it felt like it, like, no, you're not going to talk to him like that anymore and put him out of his misery. It was a fantastic way to end it. And the gunshot noise that they used probably had to have been the loudest of any gunshot we've heard in the season. You know, it's very, like, deafening. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the...
That whole scene was really, like, just brutal and visceral. I mean, I've seen very few gunfight scenes outside of this season of Penny Dreadful that have been that, like, especially Old West ones, you know, because it's just like, you shoot the gun, somebody falls. They're kind of like, oh, they fall off of something or they fall down and that's it. But you see people's heads going back, you see blood flying, you really, and it, you know, it's also because of the upgrades in technology that we've had since however long ago, pick your time. But it's louder, it's faster, it looks more realistic. You know, I mean, you just feel the bass of it just boom, especially when K-Town shoots through the wall. And, you know, I like the fact that Jared was, he was cowardly until the end because he was like, it's just me and, I forget the name of his henchman standing right there. It's just the two of us. Come in and fight us like a man, you know? And you've got like five or six people on either side of you.
But we'll just call that guy Dirty Steve.
Dirty Steve, yeah. Nobody likes Dirty Steve.
Being Dirty Steve. I can't remember his name. It was from Young Guns. They had like a Dirty Steve, I think.
Well, I like the idea that Malcolm Murray is going to be able to redeem himself by protecting both Ives and Ethan. So they're like surrogate children now to replace
Absolutely.
Mina and Peter.
Yeah, because he has so much regret. And he's such a great character. I mean, I love me some Malcolm Murray.
See, on the boat ride back over to England, like, K-Town and Malcolm Murray are just going to be like, all right, Ethan, you need to, like, rein in the werewolf side of you and this and that. Yeah. And he's going to be like, you guys aren't even my real dads. Shut up.
Yeah. K-Town's not making it back to England.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, there's that. There's that. Yeah. So we got
to. He wants to die anyway. And plus, I really don't think Ethan's going to let him live.
All right. So another great episode. It's time for feedback, folks. It's time.
Feedback.
You've listened to us prattle on about this episode. Let's listen to what you have to say about it.
I thought you were going to say, let's listen to y'all prattle
yeah,
on.
Yeah, let's listen to you guys. All right. Sharpen your axe, Crom. It is Christopher Qualcheck.
Christopher Qualicon.
Qualicon. All right. He says, just finished the last cast, and I might have an idea about the whole Ethan still calling Mr. Studi, I'm horrible at character spellings, father. A lot of native tribes had a practice of raising children or taking an orphan in war from other tribes. See Hawkeye in The Last of the Mohicans. Being raised thus, you would be considered the child of your new father and a full tribe member, almost like Athelstan in Vikings. Some taken in raids could be elevated from thrall status to full member of the community. Also, coming from a tribal society, family ties are like credentials. Also, the story of a white who joined one of the last three Apache bands would have had to have spread. Guessing that's why the old Apache lady in the saloon knew of Ethan and his father. Ooh, cool. I like this. Even if taking Ethan just to punish him, K-Town would have the cultural framework in place. Plus, who knows, maybe he does actually care about Ethan and isn't just trying to save him to stop his vision from coming to pass. Anywho, that's just an idea. I'm far from a scholar on native culture, just cobbled together from personal reading and conversations with those more learned or members of native folks. I could be close or way off the mark. Anyway, hope it was helpful.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right about that. I'm actually reading a book called Sacagawea right now. She gets taken as a slave, and she gets folded into family life of some of her captors, if you want to call it that. But it is like that. She does get adopted in a way.
Huh.
And she gets traded and gets adopted into another family, too.
Yeah, thanks, Qualicon.
Yes, thank you. We're going to hear from him again. That was what he wrote after the last episode. So we've got another letter commenting on the current episode.
All right. Up next, buckle your seatbelts. It is time for the Bib Train. All right.
I just read like the first line, started giggling. It's good. It's a good one.
underling, do not interrupt real dad when he's pointing a gun at his son. I'm sorry, he'll have to wait to kill him after Rusk arrests everybody. That's ballsy. That's a theme tonight. It's a theme. Renfield, I fear you are disappointing your master. Whoa, have some man on a meat hook. Well, well, it's fabulous hair all around in Lyle's office. Lyle, don't leave us. I second that. Meanwhile, over at When Vicky Met Henry, here's hoping Eyebrows McGee kicks Victor's ass. Make your woman a zombie love slave is never gonna fly.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've all tried it. It doesn't work. Recruiting over at Dorian seems to be going well. I did not get this take back the night memo.
Because you'd be there, right, Ben?
Yeah, because you would be there. John Clare, no angel. Couldn't Victor mix him up some useful drugs?
Oh, probably could.
Ha ha, dueling woman studies death. You are on the team, ma'am.
Yes.
Yep, our newest dreadful. Victorian women smoking and drinking in public? Where is that happening? Great advice about surrounding yourself with loved ones. Miss Hartigan, if only they hadn't run off and abandoned Buffy, Ives. Please tell me the angry prostitutes are going to practice on Vicky. All right, you got to stop this, babe. What's up with the Vicky hate?
She's...
Yeah, I don't get it. I don't understand.
She's moved on.
I guess she's so. I guess so. What did you're you gonna know, have to like let us know what he did that was so bad?
She's fickle.
You know what they say when love can turn to hate? That's what's going on here.
How many does it take to tango? Dorian, what's with the hair? Yeah, I was wondering the same thing.
Yeah.
I didn't want to say anything, but
it's not my favorite.
Oh, thank the gods. Vicky at knife point. Thanks, ladies. Maybe, see, you wanted to get the memo for this. You wanted to be there. Mm-hmm. She'd be next to Justine. Just do it. Just do it.
She, like, nudge her arm.
Oops. Dr. Seward is team eyebrows. Kill the bastards. But pushing Vanessa at Dr. Sweet. Suspicious. Oh.
See, Babe and I are on the same tip on that one.
Mm-hmm. Victor is such an idiot. Go back on the H, Vicky. Sassy to Dorian. How very unwise. Yeah, he was kind of sassy. He's like, oh, I suppose you're going to expect my gratitude. And he's like, yeah, actually. Real dad needs to quit preaching, but Russ can keep being a smart ass. All right, I'm putting it out there. I think and I hope it's a 70-30 proposition that Russ is not dead.
I didn't say it when we got to the end, but I was disappointed that his character arc ended like that. After all of the effort he's put in to hunt down Ethan, and we're sitting here along for the ride watching him do this shit, and we get to learn about his metal arm and his time in the Transvaal, and this is what it amounts to.
Yeah, all he was in the long run was just the vehicle to get him back to Texas. Or
to the States.
Yeah,
to the States. Yep, that's all he was. He was just a vehicle to get him home. It's kind of disappointing. I wanted more from him also.
Russ got some Ben-Aid.
Yep, that's about right.
More reckoning, but not quite as I hoped. The Hecate and Ethan dig in. What dead guy? There's steak. That look Ethan gives real dad. Ha. Like, talk about when he's sawing into the steak. It's Dr. Sweet working on a giant bird just like little Vanessa. Don't tell him shit. Oh, damn it. What is that crazy bleeding dress Ives is wearing?
Reminded me of because it was red and black, and it reminded me of the dress she wore to the ball.
You said it also looked like when she was on top of them and they were just about done, it looked like a bat wing spreading out.
Oh, yeah, the way her dress spread out, it looked like bat wings.
Okay, all you cowboys, you need to get on back to Bond Manor and help Vanessa, because she's smooching Dracula. Oh, and she's doing so much more, Bib, so much more. Smooth talking pimp sweet Dracula. Great good heavens, Ives on top. Prediction, Ives will go quite mad when she discovers she just humped Dracula.
That's some saggy balls.
Because he's old.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're around that long. Those things got to be dragging on the floor.
Now, that is one rowdy dinner table. What the fuck are we going to do without Rusk? Well, we're going to have about 15% less clever quotes every episode because he was just coming out with them this season. Come on. She is the worst witch ever. Make that was. Ooh. That chapel needs some burning to the ground because no spirits are ever going to rest in that place. Slayer has an album called Haunting the Chapel. I'm telling you guys, this is intentional. I laughed out loud and clapped. Bond, Malcolm Bond. My neighbors must hate me. The end.
Yeah, you know Ethan's going to burn that whole place to the ground.
All right, up next is the other Steven, the other Chandler. And he says, sorry for the absence last week, but life and a case of the flu got in the way.
Ew, that sucks.
Yeah, sorry, man. Anytime anybody's got the flu, you are excused for sure.
That's for sure.
My thoughts on last week. Ethan well and truly fell for the witchy poontang, didn't he?
He did.
Yes.
Yep. Vicky and Jekyll flip-flop again. A truly versatile relationship there. All right, there's some jokes here, but we're just going to move on. Snake attacks in the night equals kick ass.
Yes.
Lyle, why you got to break our hearts by leaving? The tide is turning in the house of Dorian Gray, and shifting power play between Lily, Dorian, and Justine may just lead to the destruction of all three of them. One can hope. Their little den of danger seems to be rapidly overcrowded, and the Dorian-Victor alliance could be the answer to their lady troubles. Yeah, I like that. Mm-hmm. I like that. That would be a cool little side thing to have those two team up. You know, just the reaction on Dorian's face when he walks into Vicky's shithole of a laboratory. You know, he would just be like, ugh, like he'd have to cover his nose with a handkerchief or something. Catriona Hartigan. Could this show stop introducing awesome characters? Seems to be our answer to the missing Van Helsing, though there could be more to her. Mm. Interesting fan theories abound, with her surname translating from German to English as Hard Sword, and her name as an anagram, The Danger, and Actor I, and links to H.G. Wells' Time Machine. Interesting. Huh. Cool. Thanks for that. Seward and Ives' ye old English Sex in the City drink scene was everything. More, please. So are you more of a Seward, or are you more of a Vanessa? I'm desperately craving a chase scene through the darkened museum during the House of the Night Creatures, and Vanessa's taste in men has proven to be, once again, notoriously horrid, though it seems that Ethan will swoop in to the rescue again. A few simple bullets took care of so many problems, and though I am sad to see Hecate's end, I'm glad Rusk is out of the picture and have the American story wrapped up thanks to Daddy Malcolm. No fan of Rusk, huh?
Or America, apparently. Yeah. Tired of looking at it.
Well, he's just frustrated, that's all. He wants them all back together.
Now get back to London, because it seems the dragon is about to strike, and I can't wait. Till then, the other Mr. Chandler.
He's talking about Victor chasing the dragon. She sent me away again.
The one thing I forgot to comment on that scene is when she's holding his head to her and she's like, go away, you know, don't come back. I'm going to be the one
he loved
holding
it.
The razor. All he's not listening. He's going boobies, boobies, boobies.
And smelling. He's like, it's what happens when you're in your 30s and you lose your virginity to a girl.
It's inevitable.
Thanks, the other Chandler.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for helping us make America great again, Mr. Chandler.
All right, up next, Dahlia General.
Salute. We salute you.
Dear M. Stephen Paul, Lyle, we got to see Lyle, but pout, not enough. And they're sending him to Egypt to investigate Imhotep, the namesake of the mummy. Hopefully that's setting the stage for season 4, which will happen, damn it. Okay, yeah. I'll calm down. But I am excited that I have finally gotten my husband into watching Penny Dreadful, and he listened with me to last week's podcast, and he loved it. Ah, awesome.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Cool, thanks, Dahlia. I have a new convert. Okay, to the episode. Loved.
This is the loved column.
We've got the loved column. The surprise from Rusk of, you're all under arrest. Say what? That once the sheriff was shot, most of the guests just kept on eating dinner.
That's a good point.
The new woman in our life. I think she and Vanessa will kick some major ass. And she is a redhead. We tend to kick ass. All of the close-ups in this episode and the predominant black and red colors together on Ives' dress in the museum, on the floor they had sex on, I'm sure there's more I missed as I only got in one viewing. I find it ironic that Dorian in previous seasons has had a pattern of finding something interesting until the next, more interesting thing came along. He thought that he and Lily would be the immortal couple, the ones to beat, and yet she's now pulling a Dorian on Dorian. Paul to sing.
Ding dong, the witch is dead, the wicked witch, the dear old bitch, ding dong.
Okay, enough, Paul. We all know the rest.
That's awesome.
Hated. We've got her hated column. Rusk's anticlimactic end. After all of that character development, I was hoping for more from his death. He and his Odo hand will be missed. Billy Lily. Once again, I say bored now. Bored now. That said, I do have a prediction. Dorian will call in that favor from Vicky and will somehow get Lily to his lab so that he can get his old lovely Lily back. Poor Vicky. Even after getting Lily back to a calmer, more gentler version, he still wouldn't get a piece of her.
Oh.
Wow.
I wish that Lily would have reminded Dorian in her "I don't really love you anymore" speech that he was one of those Johns that used and photographed her. Yes, he was kind to her, but he still was getting his kicks from the consumption bloody cough and the voyeur photographer. I feel like she stopped just short of saying it, but how I wanted to hear it. Vicky and Jekyll, would you two old boys just get it on already? I could make a joke about Hyde and Vicky's Hyde here, but I won't.
You did. You did. And it was worth it.
Another week without the Scooby Gang together. It seems as if they're headed back to London, however. Can't wait to see if Ethan meets Lily and or Dracula. Such tantalizing possibilities. I'll give this 8.5 little albino scorpions. Looking for a solid 10 next week? Fingers crossed. Cheers, Dahlia General.
Swish. Salute. Yes. Thank you.
Salute.
Thank you, Dahlia. Up next, we've got Kelly G. So Kelly says, hello, everyone. That episode had a lot going on, didn't it? Is anyone else wondering what the Ethan plot in the desert was all about? Is this supposed to show us his flirtation with evil, and will this have some impact on things to come? I do give them props for the shootout in the OK Chapel. That was intense and very Tarantino-esque. If I understand correctly, Ethan must not have surrendered to evil because in the end, he was unable to kill his own father. Luckily, Sir Malcolm, his other father, was able to do so. To me, that was like Malcolm killing the terrible father within himself. Despite what he had just heard about Ethan's crimes, Malcolm forgave him and put an end to all of the years of torment Ethan's father had dispensed. In doing so, I think Malcolm freed a bit of himself from his own guilt. Ironically, Ethan's father died on the altar in what kind of looked like a crucifixion pose. Perhaps he died to wipe away the sins of Ethan and Malcolm. And now Ethan is down to two fathers, one of which he is still pretty pissed at. Poor Vanessa. She should know by now that if she likes a guy, it is bad news. The imagery in the museum was beautiful, though. All the creatures of the night surrounded them, and unless I am crazy, the way Vanessa's dress pulled about them looked like bat wings.
Oh,
this show nice. Is amazing. And I almost want to see what it would look like for Vanessa to join with evil. I am sure it would be beautiful destruction. Thanks again for the podcast. I look forward to it every week. Kelly G.
Awesome. Thank you, Kelly.
Thanks, Kelly.
Yeah, I like the crucifixion pose that you mentioned because I didn't even think of that. And
neither did I.
When she says, is anyone else wondering what the Ethan plot in the desert was all about? And I think he had to go take care of his past so he can
move forward.
So he can move forward. Mm-hmm. So this was resolution of his storyline. So it's cutting away the extras. It's cutting the fat away, and he can just like shoot forward as the Lupus Day now. And
mm-hmm. Or the Lupus Night. No, I'm kidding.
The what?
Nothing. It's dumb.
Lupus Night.
Yeah, it's dumb.
That if he goes bad, he's a lupus.
That's
lupus
actually
knight.
Funny.
He would actually.
I wish you had said that last episode because that would have been perfect.
I can picture it not catching on. Like nobody is doing it. And he has to get a shirt printed. Like, look, it's night. All right, stop calling me day.
All right, up next, KoalaCon. So now he's commenting on this episode. No beast so fierce. And he says, oh, Rusk, we disliked you for badgering Ethan, but in the end, you were a badass. That cheeky intro to the house. I'm pretty sure he knew all about Ethan from that awkward turn of phrase at the table, and he got to be the one who dropped Hecate. Speaking of which, I get that in the heat of the moment, that Ethan, Malcolm, and Kaitane have to clear the ranch and get out. The episode ends with the headshot, but there better damn be a good conversation between the three about Hecate and not just be glossed over. Yeah, I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Dorian, you thought this was going to be a grand lark of an adventure, didn't you? A little bit more serious when you have a rage-filled acolyte trying to bump you out from your girl. But after that conversation with Dorian and Brona, after the tango, not too sure she really ever was your girl.
And you also have a house full of whores. For whatever that's worth. It's not as fun as it sounds, apparently.
No.
So, he's had a house full of whores before.
Just not all at the same time, right?
Well, you never know. Dorian might have had a house full of whores.
Yeah.
You don't know that.
I'm pretty sure he...
The guy's wanting to try anything.
Yeah.
He had, I mean, there was that one time that he had, like, all those, like, acrobats in there, like, naked and shit, you know. What?
And there was some guys without shirts on.
He's banged cowboys because he had never done it before. Mm-hmm. So, house full of whores. Yeah. It's probably one of the first few, like, things he did.
Yeah, it's old hat.
Yeah, old hat.
Victor, that was a pretty numb fuck move there, buddy. JC, tender moment thrown into your face by your son's horror at your appearance. Yeah, that sucks. Vanessa and Count Sweet.
One.
Count Sweeties.
Normally, when I'm told about a woman crying after sex, my gut reaction is to tell the guy to get the fuck out. But in this case, it's the opposite. Grab bag predictions. JC and his son. Will he be desperate enough to ask Victor to bring him back? And whenever there's vampires and someone has a case of the consumption, I'm always waiting for them to be turned.
I don't think he'll do it. I don't think he wants that kind of, like, torment, put his son through that kind of pain. Plus, you don't know if he'd ever actually grow up, so it might be, like, Interview with a Vampire.
Yeah.
I mean, he wouldn't do that. I think he'd let him die.
Yeah, the temptation might arise, but I don't think he'll follow through.
Mm-mm.
Dorian is going to team up with Victor, and by extension, maybe the rest of the crew when it reforms. Amoral hedonist or not, the fun things go away with vampire domination. General thoughts. The dinner table fight was a fantastic clusterfuck. Side note. Did you watch Barbarians Rising on History Channel? If not, you missed Torstein. What?
I always miss Torstein.
Is it a new show?
Yeah. I had somebody tweet us a preview to it. It looks good.
Barbarians Rising is the name of it?
I think it's the barbarians that sack Rome.
I know, but Barbarians Rising sounds stupid. I mean, it does. I bet it's a great show, but it'd be like anything rising just sounds terrible. It sounds like a terrible porn, you know, like Barbarians Rising. I don't know. It just doesn't sound good. I'll check it out. I mean, I'll give anything a try, but I think they could have tried a little better. Just call them barbarians, like Vikings, you know, barbarians.
Yeah, it's not a drama, is it? It's like more of a documentary kind of thing, isn't it? Or am I wrong?
I don't know.
No, it's a drama.
Oh, it is a drama. Okay.
I mean, I'm sure they'll do great. Look at what they've done with Vikings. It's just, I don't like the name.
Well, if Torstein is in it, I mean, it can't be all bad.
Of course.
Going to have a good soundtrack at any rate.
Yeah, you got to spin for the troops. I'm definitely going to check it out, though. So thanks for reminding me. I had heard something about it last week, and then we've been so busy this week. I mean, there's just no time, but I'll definitely check it, look into it.
So he goes on to say, he finishes his letter by saying, give this one an 8, just because I need a good reason from Ethan to explain his fling with Witchy Pootang, and we didn't get it. As always, love the show and trying to think what to do once the season is over.
I know what to do once the season's over. Just wait a couple more months, and then we're going to be doing Vikings again.
And Ash versus Evil Dead, too.
Yeah.
I can't wait. I was talking to Steve, and I agree. Like, I never bought the Ethan Hecate development of their relationship. So I wish they had done that a little bit better, but it's okay.
Well, and everybody's always knocking her for not being that great of a witch, but didn't her mom say the same thing? Wasn't her mom always disappointed in her? Because if her mom had been in the house, she would have been married to Ethan's dad within like an hour, hour and a half. All the cattle would have been dead because she would have used her little ring on them all. So she's slipping. You know, she wasn't nearly as powerful as her mom. That's for sure.
Yeah. She shouldn't have tried this excursion. She bit off more than she can chew here. And now she's dead. Yeah. What do they say?
Hopefully.
Bye, Felicia.
Bye, Felicia. Yes.
I think she's dead, yeah.
I think that's the general consensus here, even though I was very entertained by Hecate this season.
Oh, so, for sure.
Next up, and our last letter of the evening, is Double D's herself, the PhD Dunkin' Donuts.
The accolades that go along with Dunkin' Donuts. It's amazing.
All right, she says, this episode was crafted so amazingly well, 9.3 out of 10 pennies. Finally, an episode name with a reference I recognize and a relevant argument from Richard III. No beast so fierce but knows some touch of pity. Once again, John Logan lightly calls into question who is more compassionate, the monsters or the men. A lot of smoke, Jekyll's lab, Dorian's solar, and Jack's bedroom are hazy. The factories are choking out smoke. Vanessa smoking in the bar, Seward smoking, Malcolm smoking gun. And yet, light, the single candle next to Jack, the sunlight behind Catriona, dual lamps at drinks with Seward, the beam of light over JC in the alley, the string of lights behind Sweet. Nice. Sounds. Mm-hmm. Owls screeching in the desert surrounding Talbot Range, then two owls next to the wolf in the night creature's room, a feminine symbol.
Cool.
Nice.
Sly background cues, the redhead painting over Lily's shoulder while she talks of Justine.
She looks like Justine in that picture.
Mm-hmm.
The skull on the tapestry directly behind Jared in the chapel, the clock over Catriona's shoulder, and a second clock behind K-Town. Is he older than we think? The surprising humor of adding Rusk into the Talbot dinner. That was some of my favorite stuff in this episode. That little lopsided smirk he had. It was almost like a Han Solo-ish kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I thought he was just like, That's because you don't understand who's sitting at your table. Rest in peace, you husky-voiced dilf.
Oh, my God.
Throwing it down. Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Nice. I'm absolutely in love with the fact that they've added a Hartigan into the story. The time machine is one of my favorites. Okay, so that's two people so far who have caught a reference to the time machine, which went over my head about as high as an airplane flies. The dead zoo was so thrilling in the dark and unintentionally funny that she's asking if he can understand she's being hunted with literally thousands of heads and bodies behind her. It's kind of what I do. It's kind of what I do. Then we come to the colors, red and black and white. Not only are Vanessa and Sweet practically matching, but they end up on the floor surrounded by a grid of red and black, with her black dress swirling around them and a white hyena snarling to the right. Interesting note, the hyena totem is a symbol of integration of the male and female. Appropriate.
Wow.
Interesting note, too, Dracula is working on the eyes of a falcon, exactly like Vanessa's Ariel.
Cool.
He almost overplayed his hand right there.
Wow. Blowing my mind, donuts.
Yeah. So really what we're seeing here is the only reason to actually listen to us is because we're entertaining. You should really be just reading Donuts' blog if you want to understand what happened on the show.
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah, okay. We're all in agreement here, so we'll just move on.
Let's just shut it all down. Yeah. All right, guys, we'll see y'all never.
Shut it down.
Shut it down. It amuses me so much that no man in that era would be that forward and freaky, yet it doesn't alarm her in the least. Sure, you love me after 2.5 dates for who I am, which nobody even knows the depth of, even my werewolf protector who cast the devil out of me. Okay, Lilith, but a goddess must get her freak on occasionally. When I die, I'll haunt you from my grave. My dying curse will be Dunkin' Donuts.
A bad case of the gout.
Yeah. She says, PS1. I don't care about Lily and Dorian unless Dorian turns evil again. Surely these whores know how to use a knife already. I could have sworn JC was going to smother his kid, and that cry face, almost humorous. Sorry.
I love it. I love it.
PS2. Ethanessa returns next episode. Get hype.
All in caps. Yes.
Sorry. All right, you have been taken to school by Professor Donuts once again. I hope you took notes and you learned. Thank you very much for that letter. Everything that everybody said was relevant, insightful, surprising, you know, connecting dots here and there. That is why we want you guys to write in and participate, because it just makes it so much better.
Yes, thanks for making our podcast intelligent, everybody.
Yeah.
Yes, for sure.
All right, so that's it for tonight. Once again, if you want to write in feedback, go to our website, noship.net, and you can find the ways to contact us there, or you can just go to our email, noshipnetwork@gmail.com.
We will be returning next week. We only have 3 episodes left till the end of the season, or 3 episodes left of the season, so stay tuned. Same bat time, same wolf website, and we will see you then. This has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, M. Okay.
Till then, be who you are.